This is Audible.
Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis. Copyright 1956 by C.S. Lewis PTE Limited. The production and sale of the recorded version is licensed by the C.S. Lewis Company Limited. This unabridged recording was produced in 2000 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Nadia May. This book is 313 pages long. Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis. The book is subtitled A Myth Retold. The following material appears on the book's back cover. The timeless tale of two princesses, one beautiful and one unattractive, and of the struggle between sacred and profane love, is C.S. Lewis's reworking of the classical myth of Cupid and Psyche, and one of his most enduring pieces of fiction. C.S. Lewis, 1898-1963, gained international renown for an impressive array of works, both popular and scholarly. A science fiction trilogy, children's books, a novel, poetry, literary criticism, and numerous books on Christianity. Among his most celebrated achievements are Out of the Silent Planet, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Screwtape Letters, The Four Loves, and Surprised by Joy. The book is dedicated to Joy Davidman. Book 1, Chapter 1. I am old now, and have not much to fear from the anger of gods. I have no husband, nor child, nor hardly a friend through whom they can hurt me. My body, this lean carrion that still has to be washed and fed and have clothes hung about it daily, with so many changes, they may kill as soon as they please. The succession is provided for. My crown passes to my nephew. Being, for all these reasons, free from fear, I will write in this book what no one who has happiness would dare to write. I will accuse the gods, especially the god who lives on the grey mountain. That is, I will tell all he has done to me from the very beginning, as if I were making my complaint of him before a judge. But there is no judge between gods and men, and the god of the mountain will not answer me. Terrors and plagues are not an answer. I write in Greek, as my old master taught it to me. It may some day happen that a traveller from the Greek lands will again lodge in this palace and read the book. Then he will talk of it among the Greeks, where there is great freedom of speech, even about the gods themselves. Perhaps their wise men will know whether my complaint is right, or whether the god could have defended himself if he had made an answer. I was Orwell, the eldest daughter of Trom, king of Gloam. The city of Gloam stands on the left hand of the river Shenet, to a traveller who is coming up from the southeast, not more than a day's journey above Ringol, which is the last town southward that belongs to the land of Gloam. The city is built about as far back from the river as a woman can walk in the third of an hour, for the Shenet overflows her banks in the spring. In summer, there was then dry mud on each side of it, and reeds and plenty of waterfowl. About as far beyond the ford of the Shenet as our city is on this side of it, you come to the holy house of Ungit, and beyond the house of Ungit, going all the time east and north, you come quickly to the foothills of the Grey Mountain. The god of the Grey Mountain, who hates me, is the son of Ungit. He does not, however, live in the house of Ungit, but Ungit sits there alone. In the furthest recess of her house where she sits, it is so dark that you cannot see her well, but in summer enough light may come down from the smoke holes in the roof to show her a little. She is a black stone, without head or hands or face, and a very strong goddess. My old master, whom we called the Fox, said she was the same whom the Greeks call Aphrodite, but I write all the names of people and places in our own language. I will begin my writing with the day my mother died, and they cut off my hair, as the custom is. The Fox, but he was not with us then, said it is a custom we learned from the Greeks. But the nurse shore me and my sister Redival outside the palace at the foot of the garden, which runs steeply up the hill behind. Redivar was my sister, 3 years younger than I, and we two were still the only children. While Bata was using the shears, many other of the slave women were standing round, from time to time wailing for the queen's death and beating their breasts. But in between they were eating nuts and joking. As the shears snipped and Redivar's curls fell off, the slave said, "Oh, what a pity! All the gold gone!" They'd not said anything like that while I was being shorn. But what I remember best is the coolness of my head and the hot sun on the back of my neck when we were building mud houses, Redivar and I, all that summer afternoon. Our nurse, Bata, was a big-boned, fair-haired, hard-handed woman whom my father had bought from traders who got her further north. When we plagued her, she would say, "Only wait till your father brings home a new queen to be your stepmother. It'll be changed times for you then. You'll have hard cheese instead of honey cakes then, and skim milk instead of red wine. Wait and see." As things fell out, we got something else before we got a stepmother. There was a bit of frost that day. Redivar and I were booted, we mostly went barefoot or sandaled, and trying to slide in the yard, which is at the back of the oldest part of the palace, where the walls are wooden. There was ice enough, all the way from the byre door to the big dunghill, what with frozen spills of milk and puddles and the stale of the beasts, but too rough for sliding. And out comes Bata, with the cold reddening her nose, calling out, "Quick, quick! Ah, you filthies! Come and be clean, then, and to the king. You'll see who's waiting for you there. My word, this'll be a change for you."
"Is it the stepmother?" said Redivar.
"Oh, worse than that, worse than that. You'll see," said Bata, polishing Redivar's face with the end of her apron. "Lots of whippings for the pair of you. Lots of ear-pullings, lots of hard work." Then we were led off and over to the new parts of the palace, where it is built of painted brick, and there were guards in their armour and skins and heads of animals hung up on the walls. In the pillar room our father was standing by the hearth, and opposite him there were three men in travelling dress whom we knew well enough, traders who came to Gloam 3 times a year. They were just packing up their scales, so we knew they'd been paid for something, and one was putting up a fetter, so we knew they must have sold our father a slave. There was a short, thick-set man standing before them, and we knew this must be the man they'd sold, for you could still see the sore places on his legs where the irons had been. But he did not look like any other slave we'd ever known. He was very bright-eyed, and whatever of his hair and beard was not grey was reddish. "Now, Greekling," said my father to this man, "I trust to beget a prince one of these days, and I have a mind to see him brought up in all the wisdom of your people. Meanwhile, practice on them." He pointed at us children. "If a man can teach a girl, he can teach anything." Then, just before he sent us away, he said, "Especially the elder, see if you can make her wise. It's about all she'll ever be good for." I didn't understand that, but I knew it was like things I'd heard people say of me ever since I could remember. I loved the fox, as my father called him, better than anyone I had yet known. You would have thought that a man who had been free in the Greek lands, and then been taken in war and sold far away among the barbarians, would be downcast. And so he was sometimes, possibly more often than I in my childishness guessed. But I never heard him complain, and I never heard him boast, as all the other foreign slaves did, about the great man he had been in his own country. He had all sorts of sayings to cheer himself up with. "No man can be in exile if he remembers that all the world is one city, and everything is as good or bad as our opinion makes it." But I think what really kept him cheerful was his inquisitiveness. I never knew such a man for questions. He wanted to know everything about our country and language and ancestors and gods, and even our plants and flowers. That was how I came to tell him all about Ungit, about the girls who are kept in her house, and the presents that brides have to make to her, and how we sometimes, in a bad year, have to cut someone's throat and pour the blood over her. He shuddered when I said that, and muttered something under his breath. But a moment later he said, "Yes, she is undoubtedly Aphrodite, though more like the Babylonian than the Greek. But come, I'll tell you a tale of our Aphrodite. Then he deepened and lilted his voice, and told how their Aphrodite once fell in love with the Prince Anchises while he kept his father's sheep on the slopes of a mountain called Ida. And as she came down the grassy slopes towards his shepherd's hut, lions and lynxes and bears and all sorts of beasts came about her fawning like dogs, and all went from her again in pairs to the delights of love. But she dimmed her glory and made herself like a mortal woman, and came to Anchises and beguiled him, and they went up together into his bed. I think the fox had meant to end here, but the song now had him in its grip, and he went on to tell what followed. How Anchises woke from sleep and saw Aphrodite standing in the door of the hut, not now like a mortal, but with the glory. So he knew he had lain with a goddess, and he covered his eyes and shrieked, "Kill me at once!" "Not that this ever really happened," the fox said in haste. "It's only lies of poets, child, not in accordance with nature." But he had said enough to let me see that if the goddess was more beautiful in Greece than in Glome, she was equally terrible in each. It was always like that with the fox. He was ashamed of loving poetry. All folly, child. And I had to work much at my reading and writing and what he called philosophy in order to get a poem out of him. But thus, little by little, he taught me many. Virtue sought by man with travail and toil was the one he praised most, but I was never deceived by that. The real lilt came into his voice and the real brightness into his eyes when we were off into "Take me to the apple-laden land," or "The moon's gone down, but alone I lie." He always sang that one very tenderly, and as if he pitied me for something. He liked me better than Redival, who hated study and mocked and plagued him and set the other slaves on to play tricks on him. We worked most often, in summer, on the little grass plot behind the pear trees, and it was there one day that the king found us. We all stood up, of course, two children and a slave, with our eyes on the ground and our hands crossed on our breasts. The king smacked the fox heartily on the back and said, "Courage, fox! There'll be a prince for you to work on yet, please the gods. And thank them, too, fox, for it can't often have fallen to the lot of a mere Greekling to rule the grandson of so great a king as my father-in-law that is to be. Not that you'll know or care more about it than an ass. You're all peddlers and hucksters down in the Greek lands, eh?" "Are not all men of one blood, master?" said the fox. "Of one blood?" said the king, with a stare and a great bull laugh. "I'd be sorry to think so." Thus, in the end, it was the king himself and not Bata who first told us that the stepmother was really at hand. My father had made a great match. He was to have the third daughter of the king of Cafad, who is the biggest king in all our part of the world. I know now why Cafad wanted an alliance with so poor a kingdom as we are, and I've wondered how my father did not see that his father-in-law must already be a sinking man. The marriage itself was a proof of it. It cannot have been many weeks before the marriage took place, but in my memory the preparations seem to have lasted for almost a year. All the brickwork round the great gate was painted scarlet, and there were new hangings for the pillar room, and a great new royal bed, which cost the king far more than he was wise to give. It was made of an eastern wood, which was said to have such virtue that 4 of every 5 children begotten in such a bed would be male. "All folly, child," said the fox. "These things come about by natural causes." And as the day drew nearer, there was nothing but driving in of beasts and slaughtering of beasts. The whole courtyard reeked with the skins of them, and baking and brewing. But we children had not much time to wander from room to room and stare and hinder, for the king suddenly took it into his head that Redival and I and 12 other girls, daughters of nobles, were to sing the bridal hymn. And nothing would do him but a Greek hymn, which was a thing no other neighbouring king could have provided. "But, master," said the fox, almost with tears in his eyes. "Teach 'em, fox, teach 'em!" roared my father. "What's the use of my spending good food and drink on your Greek belly if I'm not to get a Greek song out of you on my wedding night? What's that? No one's asking you to teach them Greek. Of course they won't understand what they're singing, but they can make the noises. See to it, or your back'll be redder than ever your beard was. It was a crazy scheme. And the fox said afterwards that the teaching of that hymn to us barbarians was what grayed the last red hair. I was a fox, he said. Now I'm a badger. When we had made some progress in our task, the king brought the priest of Ungit in to hear us. I had a fear of that priest which was quite different from my fear of my father. I think that what frightened me in those early days was the holiness of the smell that hung about him. A temple smell of blood, mostly pigeon's blood, but he had sacrificed men too, and burnt fat and singed hair and wine and stale incense. It is the Ungit smell. Perhaps I was afraid of his clothes too, all the skins they were made of and the dried bladders, and the great mask shaped like a bird's head which hung on his chest. It looked as if there were a bird growing out of his body. He did not understand a word of the hymn, nor the music either, but he asked, "Are the young women to be veiled or unveiled?" "Need you ask?" said the king, with one of his great laughs, jerking his thumb in my direction. "Do you think I want my queen frightened out of her senses? Veils, of course, and good thick veils, too." One of the other girls tittered, and I think that was the first time I clearly understood that I am ugly. This made me more afraid of the stepmother than ever. I thought she would be crueler to me than to Redival because of my ugliness. It wasn't only what Butter had said that frightened me. I had heard of stepmothers in plenty of stories. And when the night came and we were all in the pillared porch, nearly dazzled with the torches, and trying hard to sing our hymn as the fox had taught us to, and he kept on frowning and smiling and nodding at us while we sang, and once he held up his hands in horror— pictures of things that had been done to girls in the stories were dancing in my mind. Then came the shouts from outside and more torches, and next moment they were lifting the bride out of the chariot. She was as thickly veiled as we, and all I could see was that she was very small. It was as if they were lifting a child. That didn't ease my fears. The little are the spiteful, our proverb says. Then, still singing, we got her into the bridal chamber and took off her veil. I know now that the face I saw was beautiful, but I did not think of that then. All I saw was that she was frightened, more frightened than I, indeed terrified. It made me see my father as he must have looked to her a moment since, when she had her first sight of him standing to greet her in the porch. His was not a brow, a mouth, a girth, a stance, or a voice to quiet a girl's fear. We took off layer after layer of her finery, making her yet smaller, and left the shivering white body with its staring eyes in the king's bed, and filed out. We'd sung very badly. Chapter 2. I can say very little about my father's second wife, for she did not live till the end of her first year in Gloam. She was with child as soon as anyone could reasonably look for it, and the king was in high spirits, and hardly ever ran across the fox without saying something about the prince who was to be born. He made great sacrifices to Ungit every month after that. How it was between him and the queen I do not know, except that once, after messengers had come from Kafad, I heard the king say to her, "It begins to look, girl, as if I had driven my sheep to a bad market. I'll learn now that your father has lost 2 towns, no, 3, though he tries to mince the matter. I would thank him to have told me he was sinking before he persuaded me to embark in the same bottom." I was leaning my head on my windowsill to dry my hair after the bath, and they were walking in the garden. However that might be, it is certain that she was very homesick, and I think our winter was too hard for her southern body. She was soon pale and thin. I learned that I had nothing to fear from her. She was at first more afraid of me. After that, very loving in her timid way, and more like a sister than a stepmother. Of course, no one in the house went to bed on the night of the birth, for that, they say, will make the child refuse to wake into the world. We all sat in the great hall, between the pillar room and the bedchamber, in a red glare of birth torches. The flames swayed and guttered terribly, for all doors must be open. The shutting of a door might shut up the mother's womb. In the middle of the hall burned a great fire. Every hour the priest of Ungit walked round it 9 times and threw in the proper things. The king sat in his chair and never moved all night, not even his head. I was sitting next to the fox. "Grandfather," I whispered to him, "I'm terribly afraid."
"We must learn, child, not to fear anything that nature brings," he whispered back.
I must have slept after that, for the next thing I knew was the sound of women wailing and beating the breast, as I had heard them do it the day my mother died. Everything had changed while I slept. I was shivering with cold, the fire had sunk low, the king's chair was empty, the door of the bedchamber was at last shut, and the terrible sounds from within it had stopped. There must have been some sacrifice, too, for there was a smell of slaughtering and blood on the floor, and the priest was cleaning his holy knife. I was all in a daze from my sleep, for I started up with the wildest idea. I would go and see the queen. The fox was after me long before I reached the door of the bedchamber.
"Daughter, daughter," he was saying, "not now. Are you mad? The king—"
At that moment the door was flung open, and out came my father. His face shocked me full awake, for he was in his pale rage. I knew that in his red rage he would storm and threaten, and little might come of it, but when he was pale he was deadly.
"Wine," he said, not very loud, and that too was a bad sign.
The other slaves pushed forward a boy who was rather a favourite, as slaves do when they are afraid. The child, white as his master, and in all his finery—my father dressed the younger slaves very fine—came running with the flagon and the royal cup, slipped in the blood, reeled, and dropped both. Quick as thought, my father whipped out his dagger and stabbed him in the side. The boy dropped dead in the blood and wine, and the fall of his body sent the flagon rolling over and over. It made a great noise in that silence. I hadn't thought till then that the floor of the hall was so uneven. I have repaved it since. My father stared for a moment at his own dagger, stupidly it seemed. Then he went very gently up to the priest.
"What have you to say for Ungit now?"
he asked, still in that low voice. "You had better recover what she owes me. When are you going to pay me for my good cattle?" Then, after a pause,
"Tell me, prophet, what would happen if I hammered Ungit into powder and tied you between the hammers and the stone?"
But the priest was not in the least afraid of the king.
"Ungit hears, king, even at this moment," he said, "and Ungit will remember. You have already said enough to call down doom upon all your descendants."
"Descendants," says the king, "you talk of descendants." Still very quiet, but now he was shaking. The ice of his rage would break any moment. The body of the dead boy caught his eye.
"Who did that?" he asked.
Then he saw the fox and me. All the blood rushed into his face, and now at last the voice came roaring out of his chest loud enough to lift the roof.
"Girls! Girls! Girls!" he bellowed. "And now one girl more! Is there no end to it? Is there a plague of girls in heaven that the gods send me this flood of them? You! You!"
He caught me by the hair, shook me to and fro, and flung me from him so that I fell in a heap. There are times when even a child knows better than to cry. When the blackness passed and I could see again, he was shaking the fox by his throat.
"Here's an old babbler who has eaten my bread long enough," he said. "It would have paid me better to buy a dog, as things turn out, but I'll feed you in idleness no longer. Some of you, take him to the mines tomorrow. There might be a week's work in his old bones even now."
Again there was dead silence in the hall. Suddenly the king flung up his hands, stamped, and cried,
"Faces! Faces! Faces! What are you all gaping at? Don't make a man mad! Be off! Away! Out of my sight, the whole pack of you!"
We were out of the hall as quick as the doorways would let us. The fox and I went out of the little door by the herb garden on the east. It was nearly daylight now, and there was a small rain beginning.
"Grandfather," said I, sobbing, "you must fly at once, this moment, before they come to take you to the mines."
He shook his head.
"I'm too old to run far," he said, "and you know what the king does to runaway slaves.
"But the mines, the mines! Look, I'll come with you. If we're caught, I'll say I made you come. We shall be almost out of Gloam once we're over that."
I pointed to the ridge of the grey mountain, now dark with a white daybreak behind it, seen through the slanting rain.
"That is foolishness, daughter," said he, petting me like a small child. "They would think I was stealing you to sell. No, I must fly further. And help me you shall. Down by the river, you know the little plant with the purple spots on its stalk? It's the roots of it I need."
"The poison?"
"Why, yes, child, child, don't cry so. Have I not told you often that to depart from life of a man's own will, when there's good reason, is one of the things that are according to nature? We are to look on life as...
They say that those who go that way lie wallowing in filth, down there in the land of the dead."
"Hush, hush, are you also still a barbarian? At death we are resolved into our elements. Shall I accept birth and cavil at—"
"Oh, I know, I know. But, grandfather, do you really in your heart believe nothing of what is said about the gods and those below? But you do, you do. You're trembling."
"That's my disgrace. The body is shaking. I needn't let it shake the god within me. Have I not already carried this body too long if it makes such a fool of me at the end? But we're wasting time."
"Listen," said I. "What's that?"
For I was in a state to be scared by every sound.
"Horses," said the fox, peering through the quick hedge with his eyes screwed up to see against the rain. "They're coming to the great door. Messengers from Fars, by the look of them. And that will not sweeten the king's mood either. Will you—" "Ah, Zeus, it is already too late." For there was a call from within doors. "The fox! The fox! The fox to the king!" "As well go as be dragged," said the fox. "Farewell, daughter." And he kissed me, Greek fashion, on the eyes and the head. But I went in with him. I had an idea I would face the king, though whether I meant to beseech him or curse him or kill him I hardly knew. But as we came to the pillar room, we saw many strangers within, and the king shouted through the open door, "Here, fox, I've work for you."
Then he saw me and said, "And you, curd face, be off to the women's quarters, and don't come here to sour the morning drink for the men." I do not know that I've ever, to speak of things merely mortal, been in such dread as I was for the rest of that day. Dread that feels as if there were an empty place between your belly and your chest. I didn't know whether I dared be comforted by the king's last words or not, for they sounded as if his anger had passed, but it might blaze out again. Moreover, I had known him do a cruel thing, not in anger, but in a kind of murderous joke, or because he remembered he had sworn to do it when he was angry. He had sent old house-slaves to the mines before. And I could not be alone with my terror, for now comes Barter to shear my head and Redivald's again, as they had been shorn when my mother died, and to make a great tale, clicking her tongue, of how the queen was dead in childbed, which I had known ever since I heard the mourning, and how she had borne a daughter alive. I sat for the shearing, and thought that, if the fox must die in the mines, it was very fit I should offer my hair. Lank and dull and little, it lay on the floor beside Redivald's rings of gold. In the evening the fox came and told me that there was no more talk of the mines, for the present. A thing that had often irked me had now been our salvation. More and more of late the king had taken the fox away from us girls to work for him in the pillar room. He had begun to find that the fox could calculate and read and write letters, at first only in Greek, but now in the speech of our parts too, and give advice better than any man in Gloam. This very day the fox had taught him to drive a better bargain with the king of Fars than he would ever have thought of for himself. The fox was a true Greek. Where my father could give only a yes or a no to some neighbouring king or dangerous noble, he could pare the yes to the very quick and sweeten the no till it went down like wine. He could make your weak enemy believe that you were his best friend, and make your strong enemy believe you were twice as strong as you really were. He was far too useful to be sent to the mines. They burnt the dead queen on the third day, and my father named the child Istra.
"It is a good name," said the fox, "a very good name. And you know enough now to tell me what it would be in Greek."
"It would be Psyche, grandfather," said I.
Newborn children were no rarity in the palace. The place sprawled with the slaves' babies and my father's bastards. Sometimes my father would say, "Lecherous rascals! Anyone would think this was Ungit's house, not mine," and threatened to drown a dozen of them like blind puppies. But in his heart he thought the better of a man-slave if he could get half the maids in the place with child, especially if they bore boys. The girls, unless they took his own fancy, were mostly sold when they were ripe. Some were given to the house of Ungit. Nevertheless, because I had a little loved the queen, I went to see Psyche that very evening as soon as the fox had set my mind at rest. And so in 1 hour I passed out of the worst anguish I had yet suffered into the beginning of all my joys. The child was very big, not a wearish little thing, as you might have expected from her mother's stature, and very fair of skin. You would have thought she made bright all the corner of the room in which she lay. She slept. Tiny was the sound of her breathing. But there never was a child like Psyche for quietness in her cradle days. As I gazed at her, the fox came in on tiptoes and looked over my shoulder. "Now, by all the gods!" he whispered. "Old fool that I am, I could almost believe that there really is divine blood in your family. Helen herself, new-hatched, must have looked so." Butter had put her to nurse with a red-haired woman who was sullen, and, like Butter herself, too fond of the wine-jar. I soon had the child out of their hands. I got for her nurse a free woman, a peasant's wife, as honest and wholesome as I could find. And after that both were in my own chamber day and night. Barter was only too pleased to have her work done for her, and the king knew and cared nothing about it. The fox said to me, "Don't wear yourself out, daughter, with too much toil, even if the child is as beautiful as a goddess." But I laughed in his face. I think I laughed more in those days than in all my life before. Toil? I lost more sleep looking on Psyche for the joy of it than in any other way. And I laughed because she was always laughing. She laughed before the third month. She knew me for certain, though the fox said not, before the second. This was the beginning of my best times. The fox's love for the child was wonderful. I guessed that long before, when he was free, he must have had a daughter of his own. He was like a true grandfather now. And it was now always we three, the fox and Psyche and I, alone together. Redivale had always hated our lessons, and but for the fear of the king would never have come near the fox. Now, it seemed, the king had put all his three daughters out of his mind, and Redivale had her own way. She was growing tall, her breasts rounding, her long legs getting their shape. She promised to have beauty enough, but not like Psyche's. Of Psyche's beauty, at every age the beauty proper to that age, there is only this to be said, that there were no two opinions about it from man or woman, once she had been seen. It was beauty that did not astonish you, till afterwards when you had gone out of sight of her and reflected on it. While she was with you, you were not astonished. It seemed the most natural thing in the world. As the fox delighted to say, she was according to nature. What every woman or even everything ought to have been and meant to be, but had missed by some trip of chance. Indeed, when you looked at her, you believed for a moment that they had not missed it. She made beauty all round her. When she trod on mud, the mud was beautiful. When she ran in the rain was silver. When she picked up a toad, she had the strangest and, I thought, unchanciest love for all manner of brutes. The toad became beautiful. The years, doubtless, went round then as now, but in my memory it seems to have been all springs and summers. I think the almonds and the cherries blossomed earlier in those years, and the blossoms lasted longer. How they hung on in such winds I don't know, for I see the boughs always rocking and dancing against blue and white skies, and their shadows flowing water-like over all the hills and valleys of Psyche's body. I wanted to be a wife so that I could have been her real mother. I wanted to be a boy, so that she could be in love with me. I wanted her to be my full sister instead of my half-sister.
I wanted her to be a slave, so that I could set her free and make her rich. The fox was so trusted by now that when my father did not need him, he was allowed to take us anywhere, even miles from the palace. We were often out all day in summer on the hilltop to the southwest, looking down on all Gloam and across to the grey mountain. We stared our eyes out on that jagged ridge till we knew every tooth and notch of it, for none of us had ever gone there or seen what was on the other side. Psyche, almost from the beginning, for she was a very quick, thinking child, was half in love with the mountain. She made herself stories about it. "When I'm big," she said, "I will be a great, great queen, married to the greatest king of all, and he will build me a castle of gold and amber up there on the very top." The fox clapped his hands and sang, "Prettier than Andromeda, prettier than Helen, prettier than Aphrodite herself." "Speak words of better omen, grandfather," I said, though I knew he would scold and mock me for saying it. For at his words, though on that summer day the rocks were too hot to touch, it was as if a soft, cold hand had been laid on my left side, and I shivered. "Bye-bye," said the fox. "It is your words that are ill-omened. The divine nature is not like that. It has no envy." But whatever he said, I knew it is not good to talk that way about Ungit. Chapter 3. It was Redivale who ended the good time. She had always been feather-headed and now grew wanton. And what must she do but stand kissing and whispering love-talk with a young officer of the guard, one Tarin, right under Bata's window an hour after midnight? Bata had slept off her wine in the earlier part of the night and was now wakeful. Being a busybody and tattler in grain, she went off straight and woke the king, who cursed her roundly but believed her. He was up and had a few armed men with him, and was out into the garden and surprised the lovers before they knew that anything was amiss. The whole house was raised by the noise of it. The king had the barber to make a eunuch of Tarin there and then. As soon as he was healed, they sold him down at Ringle. The boy's screams had hardly sunk to a whimper before the king turned on the fox and me and made us to blame for the whole thing. Why had the fox not looked to his pupil? Why had I not looked to my sister? The end of it was a strict command that we were never to let her out of our sight. "Go where you will and do what you will," said my father, "but the salt bitch must be with you. I tell you, fox, if she loses her maidenhead before I find her a husband, you'll yell louder for it than she. Look to your hide. And you, goblin daughter, do what you're good for, you'd best. Name of Ungit, if you with that face can't frighten the men away, it's a wonder." Redivale was utterly cowed by the king's anger and obeyed him. She was always with us. And that soon cooled any love she had for Psyche or me. She yawned, and she quarrelled, and she mocked. Psyche, who was a child so merry, so truthful, so obedient, that in her, the fox said, virtue herself had put on a human form, could do no right in Redivale's eyes. One day Redivale hit her. Then I hardly knew myself again till I found that I was astride of Redivale, she on the ground with her face a lather of blood and my hands about her throat. It was the fox who pulled me off, and in the end some kind of peace was made between us. Thus all the comfort we three had had was destroyed when Redivale joined us, and after that, little by little, one by one, came the first knocks of the hammer that finally destroyed us all. That year after I fought Redivale was the first of the bad harvests. That same year my father tried to marry himself, as the fox told me, into two royal houses among the neighbouring kings, and they would have none of him. The world was changing. The great alliance with Cathad had proved a snare. The tide was against Gloam. The same year, too, a small thing happened which cost me many a shuddering. The fox and I, up behind the pear trees, were deep in his philosophy. Psyche had wandered off, singing to herself among the trees, to the edge of the royal gardens where they overlook the lane. Redivale went after her. I had one eye on the pair of them and one ear for the fox. Then it seemed they were talking to someone in the lane, and shortly after that they came back.
Redival, sneering, bowed double before Psyche and went through the actions of pouring dust on her head. "Why don't you honour the goddess?" she said to us. "What do you mean, Redival?" asked I wearily, for I knew she meant some new spite. "Did you not know our stepsister had become a goddess?" "What does she mean, Istra?" said I. I never called her Psyche, now that Redival had joined us.
"Come on, stepsister goddess, speak up," said Redival. "I'm sure I've been told often enough how truthful you are, so you'll not deny that you've been worshipped."
"It's not true," said Psyche. "All that happened was that a woman with child asked me to kiss her."
"Ah, but why?" said Redival.
"Because she said her baby would be beautiful if I did."
"Because you are so beautiful yourself. Don't forget that. She said that."
"And what did you do, Istra?" asked I. "I kissed her. She was a nice woman. I liked her."
"And don't forget that she then laid down a branch of myrtle at your feet and bowed and put dust on her head," said Redival.
"Has this happened before, Istra?" said I. "Yes, sometimes."
"How often?"
"I don't know.
Twice before?"
"More than that."
"Well, 10 times?
"No, more. I don't know. I can't remember. What are you looking at me like that for? Is it wrong?"
"Oh, it's dangerous. Dangerous," said I. "The gods are jealous. They can't bear—"
"Daughter, it doesn't matter a straw," said the fox. "The divine nature is without jealousy. Those gods, the sort of gods you're always thinking about, are all folly and lies of poets. We have discussed this 100 times.
"Hey-ho,"
yawns Redival, lying flat on her back in the grass and kicking her legs in the air till you could see all there was of her, which she did purely to put the fox out of countenance, for the old man was very modest.
"Hey-ho, stepsister for goddess and a slave for counsellor. Who'd be a princess in Gloam? I wonder what Ungit thinks of our new goddess."
"It is not very easy to find out what Ungit thinks," said the fox.
Redival rolled round and laid her cheek on the grass. Then, looking up at him, she said softly, "But it would be easy to find out what the priest of Ungit thinks. Shall I try?"
All my old fear of the priest, and more fears for the future than I could put a name to, stabbed into me.
"Sister," said Redival, "give me your necklace with the blue stones, the one our mother gave you."
"Take it," said I. "I'll give it to you when we go in."
"And you, slave," she said to the fox, "mend your manners, and get my father to give me to some king in marriage. And it must be a young king, brave, yellow-bearded and lusty. You can do what you like with my father when you're shut up with him in the pillar room. Everyone knows that you are the real king of Gloam."
The year after that, we had rebellion. It came of my father's gelding Tarin. Tarin himself was of no great lineage, to be about a king's house at all, and the king had thought his father would have no power to avenge him. But the father made common cause with bigger men than himself, and about 9 strong lords in our northwest rose against us. My father took the field himself, and when I saw him ride out in his armour, I came nearer to loving him than I had been yet, and beat the rebels, but with great slaughter on both parts, and I think more slaughter of the beaten men than was needed. The thing left a stench and a disaffection behind it. When all was done, the king was weaker than he had been. That year was the 2nd bad harvest and the beginning of the fever. In the autumn the fox took it and nearly died. I could not be with him, for as soon as the fox fell sick, the king said, "Now, girl, you can read and write and chatter Greek. I'll have work for you. You must take the fox's place." So I was nearly always in the pillar room, for there was much business at the time. Though I was sick with fear for the fox, the work with my father was far less dreadful to me than I expected. He came, for the time, to hate me less. In the end he would speak to me, not certainly with love, but friendly, as one man might to another. I learned how desperate his affairs were. No neighbouring houses of divine blood, and ours cannot lawfully marry into any other, would take his daughters or give him theirs. The nobles were muttering about the succession. There were threats of war from every side, and no strength to meet any one of them.
It was Psyche who nursed the fox, however often forbidden. She would fight, yes, and bite any who stood between her and his door, for she too had our father's hot blood, though her angers were all the sort that come from love. The fox won through his illness, thinner and greyer than before. Now mark the subtlety of the god who is against us. The story of his recovery and Psyche's nursing got abroad. Barter alone was conduit pipe enough, and there were a score of other talkers. It became a story of how the beautiful princess could cure the fever by her touch, soon that her touch was the only thing that could cure it. Within 2 days half the city was at the palace gate, such scarecrows risen from their beds, old dotards as eager to save their lives as if their lives in any event were worth a year's purchase, babies, sick men half dead and carried on beds. I stood looking at them from behind barred windows, all the pity and dread of it, the smell of sweat and fever and garlic and foul clothes. "The Princess Istra!" they cried. "Send out the princess with her healing hands! We die! Healing! Healing! Healing!"
"And bread!" came other voices. "The royal granaries! We're starving!"
This was at first, while they stood a little way off from the gate. But they got nearer. Soon they were hammering at it. Someone was saying, "Bring fire!" But behind them the weaker voices wailed on, "Heal us! Heal us! The princess with the healing hands!"
"She'll have to go out," said my father. "We can't hold them."
Two-thirds of our guards were down with a fever. "Can she heal them?" said I to the fox. "Did she heal you?"
"It is possible," said the fox. "It might be in accordance with nature that some hands can heal, who knows?"
"Let me go out," said Psyche. "They are our people."
"Our rump," said my father. "They shall smart for this day's work if ever I get the whip hand of them again. But quick, dress the girl. She has beauty enough, that's one thing, and spirit."
They put a queen's dress on her and a chaplet on her head and opened the door. You know how it is when you shed few tears or none, but there is a weight and pressure of weeping through your whole head. It is like that with me even now when I remember her going out, slim and straight as a sceptre, out of the darkness and cool of the hall, into the hot pestilential glare of that day. The people drew back, thrusting one another the moment the doors opened. I think they expected a rush of spearmen. But a minute later the wailing and shouting died utterly away. Every man, and many a woman too, in that crowd was kneeling. Her beauty, which most of them had never seen, worked on them as a terror might work. Then a low murmur, almost a sob, began, swelled, broke into the gasping cry, "A goddess! A goddess!" One woman's voice rang out clear, "It is Ongit herself in mortal shape!" Psyche went on, walking slowly and gravely, like a child going to say a lesson, right in among all the foulness. She touched, and she touched. They fell at her feet and kissed her feet and the edge of her robe and her shadow and the ground where she had trodden, and still she touched and touched. There seemed to be no end of it. The crowd increased instead of diminishing. For hours she touched. The air was stifling, even for us who stood in the shadow of the porch. The whole earth and air ached for the thunderstorm, which, we knew now, would not come. I saw her growing paler and paler. Her walk had become a stagger. "King," said I, "it will kill her."
"Then more's the pity," said the king. "They'll kill us all if she stops."
It was over in the end, somewhere about sunset. We carried her to her bed, and next day the fever was on her. But she went through it. In her wanderings she talked most of her gold and amber castle on the ridge of the grey mountain. At her worst there was no look of death upon her face. It was as if he dared not come near her. And when her strength came back she was more beautiful than before. The childishness had gone. There was a new and severer radiance.
"Ah, no wonder," sang the fox. "If the Trojans and the Achaeans suffer long woes for such a woman, terribly does she resemble an undying spirit."
Some of the sick in the town died, and some recovered. Only the gods know if those who recovered were those whom Psyche had touched. and gods do not tell. But the people had at first no doubts. Every morning there were offerings left for her outside the palace, myrtle branches and garlands, and soon honey cakes and then pigeons, which are specially sacred to Ungit. "Can this be well?" I said to the fox.
"I should be greatly afraid," said he, "but for one thing, the priest of Ungit lies sick with the fever himself. I do not think he can do as much mischief at present."
About this time Redivald became very pious, and went often to the house of Ungit to make offerings. The fox and I saw to it that she always had with her a trusty old slave who would let her get into no mischief. I thought she was praying for a husband. She wanted one badly, since the king had in a manner chained her to the fox and me, and also that she was as glad to be out of our sight for an hour as we were to be out of hers. Yet I warned her to speak to no one on the way.
"Oh, make your mind easy, sister," says Redivald. "It's not me they worship, you know. I'm not the goddess. The men are as likely to look at you as at me, now they've seen Istra."
Chapter 4 Up till now I had not known what the common people are like. That was why their adorings of Psyche, which in one way made me afraid, comforted me in another. For I was confused in my mind, sometimes thinking of what Ungit by her own divine power might do to any mortal who thus stole her honour, and sometimes of what the priest and our enemies in the city—my father had many now—might do with their tongues or stones or spears. Against the latter, the people's love for Psyche seemed to me a protection. It did not last long. For one thing, the mob had now learned that a palace door can be opened by banging on it. Before Psyche was out of her fever, they were back at our gates, crying, "Corn! Corn! We're starving! Open the royal granaries!" That time the king gave them a dole. "But don't come again," he said. "I've no more to give you. Name of Ungit, do you think I can make corn if the fields don't bear it?"
"And why don't they?" said a voice from the back of the crowd.
"Where are your sons, king?" said another. "Where's the prince?"
"That king of Fars has 13 sons," said another.
"Barren king makes barren land," said a fourth.
This time the king saw who had spoken, and nodded to one of the bowmen who stood beside him. Before he'd wink, the arrow went through the speaker's throat, and the mob took to its heels. But it was foolishly done. My father ought to have killed either none of them or nearly all. He was right enough, though, in saying we could give them no more doles. This was the second of the bad harvests, and there was little in the granary but our own seed-corn. Even in the palace we were already living for the most part on leeks and bean bread and small beer. It took me endless contrivance to get anything good for Psyche when she was mending from the fever. The next thing was this. Shortly after Psyche was well, I left the pillar room where I had been working for the king, and he still kept the fox with him after he let me go, and set out to look for Redivald, that care being always on my mind. The king would have thought nothing of keeping me away from her at his own business all the day, and then blaming me for not having my eyes on her. But as it happened, I met her at once, just coming in from one of her visits to the house of Ungit, and Bata with her. Bata and she were as thick as thieves these days.
"You needn't come looking for me, Sister Jailer," said Redivald. "I'm safe enough. It isn't here that danger lies. When did you last see the little goddess? Where's your darling stepsister?"
"In the gardens, most likely," said I. "And as for little, she's half a head taller than yourself."
"Oh, mercy! Have I blasphemed? Will she smite me with thunder?"
"Yes, she's tall enough.
Tall enough to see her a long way off, half an hour ago, in a little lane near the market-place. A king's daughter doesn't usually walk the back streets alone, but I suppose a goddess can."
"Istra out in the town and alone?" said I.
"Indeed she was then," chattered Bata, "scuttling along with a rope caught up, like this, like this."
Bata was a bad mimic, but always mimicking. I remembered that from my earliest years. I'd have followed her, the young bold face, but she went in at a doorway, so she did.
"Well, well," said I, "the child ought to have known better, but she'll do no harm and come to none."
"Come to no harm," said Bata, "that's more than any of us know."
"You're mad, nurse," said I, "the people were worshipping her not 6 days ago."
"I don't know anything about that," said Bata,
who knew perfectly well. "But she'll get little worship today. I knew what would come of all that touching and blessing. Fine goings-on, indeed. The plague's worse than ever it was. There were 100 died yesterday, the smith's wife's brother-in-law tells me. They say the touchings didn't heal the fever, but gave it. I've spoken to a woman whose old father was touched by the princess, and he was dead before they'd carried him home, and he wasn't the only one. If anyone had listened to old Batter... But I at least listened no more. I went out to the porch and looked towards the city a long half-hour. I watched the shadows of the pillars slowly changing their position, and it was then I first saw how the things we have known ever since we were weaned can look new and strange, like enemies. And at last I saw Psyche coming, very tired but in great haste. She caught me by the wrist and swallowed like one that has a sob in the throat, and began leading me away and never stopped till we were in my own chamber. Then she put me in my chair and fell down and laid her head on my knees. I thought she was crying, but when at last she raised her face there were no tears on it. "Sister," she said, "what is wrong? I mean about me." "About you, Psyche," said I, "nothing. What do you mean?" "Why do they call me the accursed?" "Who has dared? We'll have his tongue torn out. Where have you been?" Then it all came out. She had gone, very foolishly, I thought, into the city without a word to any of us. She had heard that her old nurse, the free woman whom I had hired to suckle her and who now lived in town, was sick with a fever, and Psyche had gone to touch her. For they all said my hands cured it, and who knows, it might be. I felt as if they did. I told her she had done very wrong, and it was then that I fully perceived how much older she had grown since her sickness. For she neither accepted the rebuke like a child, nor defended herself like a child, but looked at me with a grave quietness, almost as if she were older than I. It gave me a pang at the heart. "But who cursed you?" I asked. "Nothing happened till I had left Nurse's house, except that no one in the streets had saluted me, and I thought that one or two women gathered their skirts together and drew away from me as I passed. Well, on the way back, first there was a boy... A lovely boy he was, not 8 years old, who stared at me and spat on the ground. 'Oh, rude,' said I, and laughed and held out my hand to him. He scowled at me as black as a little fiend, and then lost his courage and ran howling into a doorway. After that the street was empty for a space, but presently I had to pass a knot of men. They gave me black looks as I was passing, and as soon as my back was towards them, they were all saying, 'The accursed, the accursed, she made herself a goddess.' And one said, 'She is the curse itself.' Then they threw stones. No, I'm not hurt, but I had to run. What does it mean? What did I do to them?"
"Do," said I. "You healed them and blessed them and took their filthy disease upon yourself, and these are their thanks? Oh, I could tear them in pieces. Get up, child. Let me go. Even now, we are king's daughters still. I'll go to the king. He may beat me and drag me by the hair as he pleases, but this he shall hear. Bread for them, indeed. I'll—"
"Hush, sister, hush," said Psyche. "I can't bear it when he hurts you. And I'm so tired, and I want my supper. There, don't be angry. You look just like our father when you say those things. Let us have supper here, you and I. There is some bad thing coming towards us. I've felt it a long time, but I don't think it will come tonight. I'll clap my hands to call your maids."
Though the words, "You look just like our father," and from her, had hurt me with a wound that sometimes aches still, I let go my anger and yielded. We supped together and turned our poor meal into a joke and a game, and were in a fashion happy. One thing the gods have not taken from me— I can remember all that she said or did that night, and how she looked from moment to moment. But whatever my heart boded, our ruin, and even now I had no clear foresight what it would be, did not fall upon us the next day. A whole train of days went past in which nothing happened, except for the slow, steady worsening of everything in Gloam. The Shenet was now no more than a trickle between one puddle and another amid dry mud-flats. It was the corpse of a river and stank. Her fish were dead, her birds dead or gone away. The cattle had all died or been killed or were not worth the killing. The bees were dead. Lions, which had not been heard of in the land for 40 years, came over the ridge of the Grey Mountain and took most of the few sheep we had left.